Thank you, Brother John. Good morning, brothers and sisters. I must say that I omitted to tell Brother John which particular encounter it is that we are to consider this morning. So I will now tell you. It's found in the fifth chapter of John, John chapter 5, and it has to do with the man, the cripple, by the pool of Bethesda. Now, there is a certain amount of mechanical background required to this in places, and so I'm going to mix it a little bit, whereas yesterday's consideration was virtually altogether an exhortational study. This one has some small amount of expositional material in it as well. I hope there's some exhortation in it and that it's helpful, for if it's not, there's not much point in it, is there? But we'll see how it goes. Chapter 5 stands alone in John's Gospel. It's disconnected from chapter 4, which, you know, you can look at and see that it took place some time before. He went into Galilee, it says in chapter 4, verse 3. He departed from Judea and went into Galilee. And in chapter 6, we have, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And you see that he's working in Galilee in both of those places, whereas in chapter 5 it is clear that he is in Jerusalem. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And the whole of the content of chapter 5, therefore, is disconnected chronologically and also thematically, I suppose, although I must admit that I haven't exactly examined that aspect of it. It's disconnected from what went before and what comes after. We, first of all, are interested in the question as to exactly which feast it was that Jesus attended. And naturally, of course, because it doesn't say, then there is a range of possible answers. And several answers are given. Some people say the Feast of Trumpets at the beginning of the seventh month. Others say one of the newer feasts, not actually specified in the Law of Moses in Leviticus 23, one of those like Purim and so on, which were introduced by the Jews to celebrate particular aspects of their history. I'm inclined to the view myself, and it's my personal opinion, that this was probably a Passover, and I'll give you some of the reasons for it. First of all, let me turn on the overhead projector. There are four Passovers. If this that we're looking at is a Passover, there are four Passovers mentioned in John's Gospel. And for those of us who've wondered how it is that people conclude that the ministry of Jesus was of approximately 3.5 years duration, then the summary that I've got up here will help to resolve that particular question. The first Passover is in chapter 2 of John. We'll just quickly look at that. It's not really very important, but we'll just have a look at it, see that it is a Passover here. Chapter 2 of John and verse 13, and we read that the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. I'd like you just to note one small point about that as we just observe it. Early in his ministry, he had actually ministered before this. The fact that he's going up to Jerusalem implies that he'd been doing something before he went to Jerusalem. And we have more or less 6 months' activity recorded before that. Not necessarily in John, but in the other gospel records as well. But notice that the words which I've got underlined up there, if you can see them, the Jews' Passover was at hand. And I want to comment about that on that proposition shortly. The second Passover, if it was a Passover, is the feast which we are presently considering when Jesus went up to the temple in Jerusalem. And that's in John chapter 5, verse 1. I'd just like you to read again what it says there. After this, there was a feast of the Jews. And you'll notice the similarity between that, you know, a feast of the Jews, and this critical phrase up here. Not that it's all that critical, and one can't actually be certain about it, but it's helpful to think about it. The third Passover is in John chapter 6, the very next chapter to the one which we're considering. John chapter 6 and verse 4, and you'll notice the words which are there used. The Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. And we have this common factor coming through here. a feast of the Jews. It was nigh. The fourth Passover, of course, was the Passover at which Jesus was the sacrifice and was the final Passover. Now, clearly, if John chapter 5 was a Passover, then we have some justification for the notion that Jesus ministered for 3.5 years. For if we have four Passovers here, starting from the last, there is a year to the one before, a year to the one before that, and a year to the one before that. That encompasses a period, elapsed, of 3 years, and then whatever was before in the earlier Galilean ministry gives us approximately 6 months. I'd like to just say in passing that if John chapter 5 is not a Passover, then we have little real grounds for, setting the duration at 3.5 years. We could guess on the likelihood and the probabilities, but it's really only a guess. It's quite a remarkable thing that such an important aspect of the development of the purpose of God should not actually be laid out in chronological order. What it means, of course, is that that is not particularly important, for if it were, it would have been laid out without doubt. Now, having discussed that, I would now like to consider this phrase, which stands out like a sore toe to me, when it says there was a feast of the Jews. And I would like to just now change the projector transparency and just consider the ways in which John uses that phrase in his gospel. That transparency's got a curl on it. I hope it's still in focus. He uses the phrase Jews, or the word Jews, as it seems to me, in three different ways. And sometimes we need to be aware of this as we read his record. First of all, he can mean a Hebrew, that is, a descendant of Jacob. One who is physically descended from Jacob is, in John's estimation, a Jew. There's a reference there, John chapter 4, verses 9 and 22. I'm not going to look it up because it's a mechanical detail which is unimportant. The second thing is, he can mean an inhabitant of Judea or Jerusalem, locating it more specifically within the confines of Jerusalem. And I have a couple of references there, John chapter 7, verse 1, John chapter 11, and verse 54. But there is a third way in which he uses the word Jew, which seems to me to be peculiar to John. He has actually a number of peculiarities. One of them is his timekeeping method, which seems to differ from the normal Hebrew practice, but that's another subject. He can mean, and he seems sometimes to mean by the use of the phrase Jews, he can mean a sympathizer with the Pharisees or the Sanhedrin itself, the direction of which was in the hands of the Pharisees. Now, admittedly, the high priest was a Sadducee, but it was the Pharisees who called the tune because of their influence over the people in the time of Jesus. Now, of those references which are given there, probably the best to look at is John chapter 11 in verse 46. You'll find there the record of Caiaphas giving counsel in verse 46 of John 11. Some of them went their ways to the Pharisees. The chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What are we going to do? This man does many miracles. If we leave him alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation." And one of them, named Caiaphas, gave counsel, "You know nothing at all. You don't consider that it's expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that all the nation should perish." He didn't speak this of himself, and so on. We remember that record. Now, keeping that in mind, go to chapter 18 and have a look. There is an allusion to that. Remember that this council of Caiaphas was given to the Sanhedrin. They gathered the council, and he was addressing the Sanhedrin. Now, this is not conclusive evidence, but it's a fairly good indication of the special way in which John uses the word Jew sometimes. In verse 14, "Caiaphas was he," it says in John 18, verse 14, "Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people." And while it's perfectly true that he spoke to the Sanhedrin as representing the whole nation, nevertheless, his counsel was addressed to the Sanhedrin. And to that extent, I think we're justified in concluding that John can mean by the word Jews the Sanhedrin, the Pharisee-dominated section of the community. And this is verified to some extent in verse 31 of the same chapter, where it says, Pilate said to them, "Take ye him and judge him according to your law." The Jews, therefore, said unto him, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." And you know who it was who said that. Naturally, it was the ruling people. So there's a small mechanical detail. Seems to me that there's a lesson in this. I want you to notice the way in which John has said in three occasions of the Passover that it was a feast of the Jews. And I want you to just keep that in your head and now turn to Leviticus 23 and a dozen other places in the Old Testament. Leviticus 23 is, of course, the place where the feasts are summarized. Just keep that contrast, or look for a contrast. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say unto them, concerning the feasts of the Lord." And see the difference. Now, consistently, where the law of the feasts is given, they are the feasts of the Lord. They did not belong to the Jews, although the Jews were to observe them. And I want you to see that there is a subtle influence has operated throughout the years from the time when the law was given. And incidentally, in Leviticus 23, you'll find that the very first substantial feast which is mentioned, that is after the Passover, after the Sabbath, is the Passover, which is what we're discussing. I want you to see how subtly these things can operate in our lives and in our experience. What has started off as a clearly stated feast of the Lord has now become a feast of the Jews. And this reveals a subtle difference in attitude, of outlook towards what's going on. And it's a salutary warning, I believe, to ourselves. For we have started off in the truth with a clear idea that our attendance at meetings and our attendance at Bible schools and our looking into the Word of God is to further our spiritual understanding of the God of heaven and to further worship Him in whatever way that we can. Is it not? Now, it seems to me that this indicates that there is a serious danger that we may digress from that and begin to think of all the activities in which we may become engaged as in some ways serving our community or serving ourselves. And in a subtle kind of way, although we do everything to God and we pray to God and we sing hymns and so on, we're conscious of our community and think of it as being good for the community. And it becomes a sort of self-serving objective. Now, you might think that that is a little high-flown and maybe finely drawn, but I find it difficult to resist that kind of conclusion, especially knowing the way in which the Pharisees and those who were with them performed. And I believe that we ought to take notice of this and particularly take warning about that which seems to be implied in just that little phrase there right at the outset. Well, there it is. It was, perhaps sadly, the Feast of the Jews at this time rather than the Feast of the Lord. Nevertheless, Jesus went up. And that also seems to me to be a very helpful notion. You see, Jesus had the choice. He could have stood up and denounced all that was going on and said, "This is a sham. You people are doing this for your own objectives. You have no consciousness of God left in your minds. You pay lip service to Him, but you don't actually worship Him with your hearts." And he had a choice. He could have stood up and said that and said, "I won't touch that with a barge pole. You can do what you like, but I won't be there." On the other hand, he could have said, "I know that my brethren have got their shortcomings, and I know that they have deflected the clear intention of the law to something which is somewhat less than what it was intended to be. But that, nevertheless, I will support them." And the fact that the Lord went up to Jerusalem at that time, went into Herod's temple, which had been made a den of robbers, and called it his father's house, is to my mind a most helpful notion. Because there are times when, quite frankly, you're going to be honest with yourself, you're going to get disgruntled with your brothers and sisters. You're going to see our lot as a rather unspiritual, self-serving, kind of worldly lot from time to time. Is that true? I mean, seriously, we think this sometimes. We throw up our hands and say, "What's going on?" Quite overlooking, of course, for the moment that we are sometimes prone to the same thing. But Even if we are convinced that our brethren have lost their way for the time being, is that cause for us to go out the door? Is that cause for us to say, I will have no part of this? Of course not. Because the Lord went to Jerusalem where there was being celebrated a feast of the Jews. And that should be helpful to us. It's certainly helpful to me. It has been on a number of occasions when I've been a little bit, where do you go from here? You know the feeling, I'm sure. So there he is. He goes up to Jerusalem. And it's a very interesting matter that he didn't actually, at least he went into the temple, of course, but that's not where the real action was. Why? Because, of course, the things that were going on in the temple had been deflected. So Jesus set his own scene. And he looks at the condition of the people at that time, prostrate and well-nigh perhaps spiritually dead. And he sets about in his own way to correct this. And what we have here is a record which declares the means by which Jesus achieved that end. To what extent he was successful, of course, we can't say because the scriptures don't tell us. But he certainly tried, and that, of course, is helpful to us too. And the bottom line down here in John 5 is that we don't know who he persuaded by his arguments and demonstrations. We don't know that anybody was affected. Are we therefore going to conclude that it was a waste of time his trying? And are we similarly going to conclude that just because we hold special lectures and general lectures and put pamphlets into letterboxes and so on, and nobody comes and nobody responds, that we're going to quit? Well, of course not, because Jesus went up there and he did what he could. And that's what we do too, isn't it, brothers and sisters? He didn't go to the temple because at this stage it was not the appropriate place to go. Where he went was, I believe, in the shadow of the temple. And what I would like to do now is change the projector transparency again and just put up a map of Jerusalem. Now, what we've got there is a picture of Jerusalem, as far as my Bible atlas is able to give it to me, of just a layout map. The temple is here, and the place that he evidently went was there. And most people agree about that, although there is some discussion about it. The Pool of Bethesda, the House of Mercy. Perhaps there is some variation about that. Some people call it Bethzatha because it's the region in which the pool is to be found. It's interesting that this pool there is in the shadow of the temple. I've got another projector transparency, which I'll change in a minute, which shows a view from this corner, looking in that direction there. It's kind of a perspective drawing, and it's helpful to just to see how it goes. I'll put it up. Now, I hope that shows it. What we've got here is we're standing there looking from this direction here. That's from the northwest corner, looking at the temple. And the pool is reckoned to be down in this valley, deep down below the walls of the temple. Now, if this is looking from the north, and of course this is a northern hemisphere, the sun is over there on the southern side, and it took place down here in the shadow of the temple. And what we have is a picture of this man who, because of the infirmity that he had, was not able to get up to the temple. And if he'd gone up there, what could they do for him up there? And Jesus comes to this place and meets this man. I've just got a few things to say about the Pool of Bethesda, and we'll put up the appropriate projector transparency. That's the wrong one. We'll try this one. Okay. And what we find happened here is that Jesus goes in there, and in verse 3, in these five porticos of the pool, there lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind and halt and so on, waiting for the moving of the water. The name given there in the Authorized Version, Bethesda, it was a pool apparently near the Sheep Gate, and you'll find that in the margin there. House of Mercy, modern variations occur. The most frequent variation is Bethzatha. In 1888, an excavation uncovered a pool with five porches in northeast Jerusalem. A faded fresco on the wall showed an angel and water. suggesting earlier Christians thought the pool to be Bethesda, and that's taken from the Westminster Bible Dictionary. But there are other explanations. Now, if the northeast corner of Jerusalem was the true site of the pool, the miracle took place then literally, as I said, in the shadow of the temple. Now, what we find Jesus doing there is walking in to see the people who were gathered there waiting for the troubling of the water. And another small academic thing which needs to be pointed out is that the last part of verse 4, where it says, "Whosoever then first after the troubling of the water stepped in was made whole," and the first part of chapter 5, "A certain man was there which had an infirmity of 38 years," the end of verse 3 and the beginning of verse 4, I got the wrong piece. The end of verse 3, "waiting for the moving of the water, for an angel went down at a certain season into the pool." That is not contained in many modern translations. And so we have to make a decision what we're going to do with it. If it is spurious, if it shouldn't really be there, at least the intent of the idea of the people clustered around there waiting for the angel to move the water so that they could get in to be healed, at least the intention must be true, because verse 7 is not contested. And you'll see that in verse 7, the impotent man said to Jesus, "Sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool, but while I'm coming, another steps down before me." And some disturbance must be implied. Otherwise, why were they just waiting around the pool? They were clustered around the pool. If they thought the water could fix them, why weren't they in the water? They were waiting for something to happen, clearly. And why should it matter to the cripple if it was the water that healed, or if they thought the water healed, that somebody got down before him? Clearly, it was a one shot. And what they were waiting for was some special intervention of disturbing the water or something like that so that they could go in. The idea being the first person in would then be healed. And so Jesus comes to this place, and you'll notice the critical thing. There are a lot of people there. In verse 3, "and these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, and all manner of diseases and problems were present, blind, halt, withered, and they were there," as I believe, "waiting for the moving of the water." I think probably the way we can read this is that the text could perhaps mean it was said that an angel went down at a certain season. And this is just the kind of superstition which people will grow up with, in a way. I should tell you an amusing story, actually. In New Zealand, a few miles north of where we live, there is, on the main road, on a rocky hillside, as the road goes down the side, there's a little waterfall which flows year in and year out, winter and summer. And until a little while ago, you'd drive past it 100 times and never notice it, until some girl was there at the summertime, and she looked up and she saw in the spray from the waterfall what she thought to be a vision of the Virgin Mary. And she went home and told everybody about it, and now it's a right circus. You can go there at any time, and you'll find cars up and down the road, and people standing there splashing this water on. In wintertime, I guess that if it doesn't cure them, it's going to kill them. But they believe that this is so, you see. And I think that what we have here is an ancient counterpart of that same kind of spirit. And I think you know the sort of thing that is alluded to. But here he is then in a hopeless position. He can't go up to the temple because the temple can't do anything for him. He can't get into the temple, chances are, because he can't walk and because his disability disqualified him under the law. The priest couldn't do anything for him. And here he is sitting by the pool, and he can't even get into the pool, as he says. Why he's there, who knows? And you see the way in which some people are looking for what they do not even know, and they have no chance of ever achieving it. Once again, you see our responsibility to spread the gospel record, to be ready to talk to people and to give them that which sometimes they're not even aware that they are looking for. And here we have an example of it. Well, here is this man, a certain man, verse 5, was there, which had an infirmity 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lie and knew that he'd been a long time in that case, he said to him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" I want you to notice that if Jesus had been, as the Pentecostal evangelical churches say, a person who is principally concerned with physical well-being, a healer, and whose objective was to make this life comfortable, he could have had a field day in that place. There was a great multitude of impotent folk there, blind, halt, withered, and if he'd been there just to heal, he could have spent the whole day there. You know, what's your problem? Fix him, and you know, done what the evangelicals do today, or at least claim to do, to heal people. He did not do it, and I think it's important for us to realize that. And if anybody tells you that we ought to be more concerned with healing and all those physical things which the evangelicals are on about, this is an excellent place to go. Because not only did Jesus go into that place and look around and pick out one particular person who was exactly qualified. You notice the criteria, that he had been a long time in that condition and that he was lying. He was prostrate. When Jesus knew that those two preconditions were met, he picked him out. He healed him, and then the record says he took himself away. He turned around and he walked out quickly before it was even realized properly what had happened. And so there was didactic intent. He was here to teach. He was not here to heal per se, although naturally he healed when he had need, and this is one of these cases. And it's interesting also to look at verse 5 and observe this curious little fact, which is just put in there, apparently just gratuitously. What does it matter that the man had been there 38 years? Does that matter? Is that important? And what about the other men that were in a similar case and were within range? For instance, in Acts chapter 3, verse 1, and in Acts 4, verse 22, we'll find a case of another man who must have been within a few feet of this man and was apparently overlooked by the Lord. What is it about the 38 years and the chronic condition and the prostration of this man which is important? Now, this is the kind of thing which, when we're reading the word, should ring bells in our head and make us stop and think. It's not necessarily that we're going to get a definitive answer to the question, but at least the raising of the question will help us perhaps to get a greater insight into what's going on. I'm going to suggest to you that the solution to the question about the 38 years is found in Deuteronomy. And many of you will already have gone there, I'm sure. As soon as you saw 38 years and heard me say, what about this 38 years? You would begin to look at Deuteronomy 2 and verse 14. Now, I've taken the trouble to go through Strong's Concordance and look up every reference to 38 years in the Scriptures. And as far as I'm aware, this and one other case that I'll point out to you, which is a curious inverse of this, are the only two other places where 38 years occurs, except for incidentals like something a king reigning for 38 years, of which there were one or two, and they don't seem to be related to anything in particular. But in verse 14 of Deuteronomy 2, we have the interesting piece of information that it was exactly 38 years from the time that the children of Israel were deflected at Kadesh Barnea and prevented by the Lord from going into the land until they crossed over the plains, over the brook Zered, into the plains of Moab. And I'm suggesting, therefore, that Jesus has picked this man out for that very reason. This is the only other really significant place in Scripture where 38 years appears. And I believe that what he's done then, he's picked this man out to form a kind of object lesson for the spiritual condition of the Jews in Jesus' day. And he's got him here then as a symbol of their condition. Here they are prostrated by that which they regard as sin. It is sin which makes the man impotent in the end, and the law of Moses is at pains to point that out. That although you can't actually say that specific disease follows as a result of specific sin, nevertheless, it's true that disease and impotence in general comes about as a result of sin. And this man is prostrate. He can't even carry himself. He can't walk. He can't proceed. He's got nowhere to go. He just lies there. Furthermore, he wants to get out of that condition, maybe, but he's totally powerless to do it. There is no mechanism at his hand which would correct his position. He can't go up into the temple, and if he did, it wouldn't help.
because only the law was administered up there. And he can't even get into the pool because when he's going, somebody else gets in front of him. And there's no guarantee it's going to work anyway. So the condition is hopeless. And what we have, I believe, is a picture of Israel in the time of Christ, prostrated by their preoccupation with things which did not pertain to God. And this is a lesson, I believe, to us. So when Jesus saw him lying, knew that he'd now been a long time in that case, he said to him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" And there are two points which need emphasizing there. First of all, wilt thou be made whole? Notice that. You see that it's necessary that when we realize, as Israel had to realize, that sin prostrates us and that we're totally powerless to fix it, we have nevertheless to will to be corrected, to be made whole. Now that's important. These things will not just come to us, brothers and sisters, and it's important to realize that we have to maintain the willingness to have the redemptive power of Christ imputed to us. That willingness needs to be there all the time. The second thing is the realization that it is necessary that we be made whole. There is no process that we can undertake which will correct the imbalance. It is necessary that we be operated on, in a way, and that we be made whole. You see how this is set forth as something which is external to us and is applied from the outside. And the impotent man looks at the situation and says, "It's hopeless. How can it be? I mean, I like the idea." "Sure," he says. "I want to be made whole. Why do you think I'm here?" Okay, but how? And "I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool." And the beautiful thing here is that the Lord Jesus Christ steps over this boundary. With man, it is impossible. With God, all things are possible. And Jesus just steps over the barrier. The man says, "I can't do it. I've got no mechanism. I have no man." Very interesting matter that. It's very worthwhile to go back and have a look at Isaiah 59. And just think about the prostration of Israel in Isaiah 59. My time's running out. I guess that I can... I've got two or three passages. I'll tell you the other two, and you can look for others as well, because this is not the only place by any means. Isaiah 59 and verse 16. "He saw there was no man. He wondered that there was no intercessor. Therefore his arm brought salvation unto him, and his righteousness, it sustained him. There was no man." "I have no man," said the cripple by the pool. Look at the content of Isaiah 59. I hope I'm not treading on anything that Brother John is commenting on. I see him shaking his head. Well, I'll go ahead then. Look at the content of Isaiah 59. "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear. The Lord is able to do it. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God." That's the problem. It's sin within us, which is the difficulty. "Your iniquities have separated between you and your God. Your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear." You see. "Your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity." I want you to think of the condition of the Jews in Jesus' day and look at it in relation to this. This, I believe, is a latter-day prophecy. It has yet to be fulfilled. It's going to be true. It is coming true before our eyes now, but think of it in the context in which Jesus was operating. "None calls for justice. None plead for truth. They trust in vanity. They speak lies. It had become a feast of the Jews. It was no longer the feast of the Lord." Do you see? "They hatch cockatrice eggs and weave the spider's web," and so on. Verse 8, "The way of peace they don't know. There's no judgment in their goings. They've made them crooked paths. Whosoever goeth therein shall not know peace." True. "Therefore is judgment far from us, neither doth justice overtake us. We wait for light, but behold obscurity." I'm going to talk about the light of the world in a day or two also, and it's all related to this. And you go through and you read it, and you see that this is it. And God looks around, there's no man. And the faithful in Israel who would come to God, they look around. "I have no man," he says. And here is Jesus, the man. You know, and all those beautiful prophecies of the servant and the man, my fellow, from Zechariah. Here is the man. And he had a man. There he was, right in front of him, who picked him up, didn't put him in the pool, picked him up. Better than that, he gave him the strength to pick himself up, which is far better, isn't it, when you think about it? What a fantastic idea that is. I said I'd give you another couple of references to look at. Ezekiel 22, verse 30. Very similar in spirit. Ezekiel 22, verse 30, and Jeremiah 5, verse 1. Then pick out the marginal references and see how it spreads. All right? At least I hope it does in that case. It usually does. I can't remember specifically checking on that. But check it out. There you go. There are three references anyway. Rather nice. So as we see that man there saying to Jesus, I have no man. What is he doing? He's asking the Lord, Jesus Christ, to do this for him. Yes, he says, I want to be made whole, but I need the person to do it. And Jesus just, he doesn't say, well, I'm the one. He just gets on with the job. You see? Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. There are three steps, rather like the man with dropsy, you know, where Jesus took him and healed him and let him go. Three steps in the process. And here we have another three steps. Rise. Well, of course, if we're prostrated by sin, are we going to stay like that? We've got to do something about it. You'll notice that Jesus didn't just reach down, pick him up, prop him on his feet, and then give him a nudge to get him going. He gave him the power to do it himself. And although we may fall from time to time, brothers and sisters, nevertheless, the proposition is clear for each one of us that we are expected to rise. Lift up our eyes and look beyond the horizon of what we see around about us. As Paul says in Colossians, you know, look to those things which are above and seek those things which are above. Elevate our way of thinking. Lift up our eyes. Don't just look down here at the ground all the time. But more than that, you've got to do some work. You've got to take your bed. Now, the bed, of course, was that which had kind of contained him throughout the rest of his life, the earlier part of his life. And it's not as though we're necessarily going to be able to throw all that away. We have still to live within the constraints of what is here. We're dealing with a realistic situation. You can't actually leave the world at the present time. But, you know, in our new condition, we'll be able to carry that burden, which before had carried us. We'll be able to carry it. We'll have a strength which we didn't necessarily have before. And furthermore, we're not just going to put it on our shoulder and hold it there. We are going to walk. The proposition is that we should go forward. Now, I guess there are times when it's very easy for us just to sit back and do nothing. I can tell you that, you know, sort of preparing endlessly as it seems. I've spent 6 or 8 months on this series of Bible school talks, and I've done just about nothing else. And I've been back into the study, sometimes coming home for lunch and I'd have 10 minutes and I'd go in and turn on the monitor on the computer and get back into it. Put the mind into it. And it's a weariness after a while. You feel as though you want to do something else. Just put your feet up, watch a film on television or whatever, you know, and you can't necessarily stop. One thing we've got to understand, brothers and sisters, we've got to keep moving. If we stop and put our feet up, then we're going to start to sink again and regress to our original condition. Seems to me to be an important observation here that the Lord has laid on this man. But you'll notice that there's something else. When he carried his bed on his shoulders, he was advertising the work of Christ in his life, because Jesus had done something to him to change him around and then told him to do on the Sabbath day that which those around about would object to. And so Jesus was saying, you have a responsibility to advertise that something special has happened to you. And he sets out, as he goes away, carrying the bed, advertising the fact that Jesus had healed him. And you know that that immediately began a controversy and actually was the subject of that which Jesus was to discuss with the people later on. You see, it is necessary, therefore, that we testify to the process which has happened within us. And that's what the man did, tacitly, by carrying the bed. Isn't it interesting? Isn't it an insight into the nature of the people who objected to his doing that, that they evidently didn't object to the people who carried him there? Now, you see, it was the Sabbath day, and he was by the pool. He didn't carry his bed there. He carried it away, but he didn't carry it there. How did he get there? Well, obviously, somebody must have carried him, put him down there in the shadow of the temple, and then gone up to the temple, presumably, to do what they were going to do, and left him there. But who raised an objection to his being carried there? Now tell me, which is more work? To carry a bed with a man on it, or to carry a bed? And who was objecting to his being carried there? And what I want you to notice is that the mind of the Pharisee is very often selective. They will object to some things, but they'll let other things go right by. Swallowing a camel and straining out a gnat, you know, that kind of stuff. All right, there it is. And they said to him, "Who told you? What are you doing carrying a bed on the Sabbath day?" Verse 10. It's the Sabbath day. What are you doing carrying a bed? He answered, "He that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk." Notice the implication of that. He is saying effectively, don't talk to me about the Sabbath law. If a man can make me whole after 38 years of prostration like that, don't talk to me about the Sabbath law. If he tells me to carry the bed, I carry the bed. All right? And you notice the way in which he puts it. But observe the mind of the Pharisee again. They didn't say, "Who made you whole? You know, that's fantastic. Who made you whole?" They didn't say that. "Who told you to carry a bed on the Sabbath day?" Observe the mind of the Pharisee. See that? Now, what was the important issue here? Was it carrying a bed or was it being made whole? Ask yourself. Okay? And which of those issues occupies the mind of the Pharisee? And now ask yourself, which sort of mind have you got? Seems to me to be a fair question. I ask myself. I understand the problems which are caused by this kind of thing. And I think that it's a difficult question. I don't know the answer to that question. But when you see it like this, it seems pretty clear which way we ought to be, doesn't it? Okay? And he didn't know who it was, because Jesus had taken himself away. There was a crowd in the place. And the nice thing about that is that Jesus had made the healing, had done the healing, the man was corrected, everybody saw it, Jesus took himself away. And he left everybody to consider it and draw their own conclusions. And that's, I think, important. The matter was not resolved, however, because Jesus found him again in the temple in verse 14. I'm going to have to stop in a minute and a half. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple. He said to him, "Behold, thou art made whole." He didn't say you've suffered spontaneous remission or experienced spontaneous remission. He said, "You've been made whole," right? That's true for us too. Okay? And he carries on. He says, "Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon thee." Had the man sinned to be like that? Seems unlikely. But you see then that the issue really was about sin. That's it. Jesus has said, what's happened to you is a kind of a model for what can happen to all and what needs to happen to the nation. Don't sin, lest the worst thing comes upon you. Of course, the worst thing is death in the end. But there are allusions to the parable, you know, about the house that's swept out. And the demon goes out and he says, "Well, I got nowhere to live." I know. And he gathers seven more and goes back. And the last state is worse than the first. And then there was a discussion. The man, of course, then went and told the Jews. I'm not sure really whether he was a bit naive or what. But first of all, you see that the encounter with the Lord was therefore completed. Jesus found him. He was looking for him. He looked for him, found him. Then you find the man goes and tells the Jews. And the Jews called Jesus up before the Sanhedrin, evidently, and he stands now and gives his defense, which we haven't time to go into this morning. But I would just like to point out that there are actually three issues, really, which are dealt with by the Lord. And I'm just going to point these out, and you can do the reading yourself and think about it. In verse 16 on, they persecuted Jesus and said, "What are you doing working on the Sabbath days, or telling a man that he can carry a bed on the Sabbath day?" Jesus answered. Verse 17, and here's another one of his ways of dealing with the Sabbath controversy. He says, "My Father works hitherto, and I work. Don't tell me that God stops working on the Sabbath," he says, "for that's the time when the works of God are most clearly made manifest. God works on the Sabbath. If he were to withdraw his spirit and his breath, we'd all perish." Okay? That aside from spiritual things. God works on the Sabbath, therefore I work. But you see, he says, "My Father works hitherto." And now the Jews say, "What is this? You tell a man that he can carry a bed on the Sabbath, and now you say that God is your father, and they had him on two scores. They were discontented with him for two reasons. And he first of all deals with the second of those. He establishes his authority. It's a tremendous discussion here from verse 19 on, where he establishes his authority. Then in verse 25 and 27, he draws the conclusion for them out of the demonstration concerning the impotent man. And I want you to notice that the discussion is about resurrection, and he does so in two phases. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. In verse 26, for as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself. Very interesting, the doctrine of the Godhead here. Jesus acknowledges the Father's superiority, and he says that his authority is derived from the Father. The Father has given him the authority. He hadn't authority of his own right. It was given him. But inasmuch as it was given, it must be recognized. And I think there's a lesson in that for Christadelphians as well. Not so bad these days as we perhaps were 20 years ago in our emphasis to move away from the Trinity. We rather demeaned the position of Jesus, I think, from time to time. At least in our area of the world, I think that was true. And it's not so true today. But notice the point here. The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God. How can the dead hear the voice of the Son of God? I mean, if they're dead, they're in the grave. You know, in the grave, you can't hear it, you can't know anything. He's not talking about that. These are the dead who must bury their dead. These are the people who are prostrated by sin. These are the people who, like the man there for 38 years, and like the nation now, with their preoccupations and their divergences from the truth, needed to hear the voice of the Son of God. And they needed to know his authority and the fact that he was all-powerful in the things of man, because the Father had given him that authority. And that is the basis of that discussion to that point. And he's given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. And there's a warning in that to those Pharisees. You better be careful, or you get the judgment. All right, and then finally, the physical resurrection, verses 28 and 29. Don't marvel at this. Don't be surprised. The hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice. A somewhat qualified all, as we know, and shall come forth. And this, brothers and sisters, is the bottom line as far as we're concerned, isn't it? That we should listen to the voice of the Son of God and to realize that in this we have the solution to our problems, and look forward to the physical resurrection which follows from the rise in our spiritual apprehensions as a result of our hearing his word. Thank you very much.